Blog Talk Radio.
Bring
Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Saturday, July 3rd, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. We want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to another edition of our program. Later on in this episode, we'll feature our Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the capsizing of a boat carrying migrants off the coast of Tunisia. There are reports of deaths and injuries. The Ethiopian National Defense Forces have withdrawn their troops from the Tigray region of the Horn of Africa state. We'll have details on that as well. Also, protests inside the Southern African state of the Kingdom of Eswatini, also known as Swaziland, has drawn international attention. And a monument to the life, times, and contributions of Miss Ida B. Wells Barnett was unveiled earlier in the week in Chicago. In the second hour, we listened to a briefing from the World Health Organization in Geneva discussing the COVID-19 pandemic and other global health issues. Finally, we examined some of the news events on the African continent as well as internationally. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take a musical interlude with the Orchestra Bella Bella and Soki Vangu from 1975. Let's listen in.
Kanisa pambindoje shushu uyo moliko na kamwe na bakio nilengelo kola yo makanisi ya mokolo gana nimeo bomo inanga inyoso na pesi na yo tovanda na yo Thank you.
Thank you. Bobo kola na emeti na koni moto. Me kama na
Welcome back, and that was the music of Orchestra Bela Bela from the Democratic Republic of Congo, music from the mid-1970s, and right now we want to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment of our program, and our lead story deals with the ongoing crisis of migration off of the coast of North Africa. In Tunisia, at least 43 migrants drowned off the coast earlier today, and 84 others were rescued after their boat capsized overnight. And that's according to the Tunisian Red Crescent. Mongi Slim, head of the organization, told the Associated Press that the boat, which was carrying 127 migrants, left Libya's coastal city of Zawara yesterday to cross the Mediterranean Sea towards Italy. He said 46 Sudanese, 16 Eritreans and 12 Bengalis were among the migrants. The Defense Ministry spokesperson, Mohammed Zakri, said the 84 migrants were rescued by fishermen. He declined to confirm the drowning of other migrants. Libya is a frequent departure point for migrants, making a dangerous Mediterranean Sea crossing. Several shipwrecks from smugglers' boats carrying migrants have occurred in recent weeks, as attempts to reach Europe became more frequent amid warmer summer weather. Last week, Tunisia's coast guards found 7 bodies on the beaches of Djerba, an island off the southern coast. They were buried at the cemetery for migrants in Zarzis, Tunisia, in the Mediterranean Sea. The head of the Red Crescent, meanwhile, launched an urgent call about the fate of hundreds of migrants to escape death, as his organization has no means to provide housing. The 3 centers in Zarzis are full and cannot shelter more people. We also have 380 other migrants in the confinement in Djerba with nowhere to go, Slim said. And in the Horn of Africa nation of Ethiopia, the Ethiopian government call, the ceasefire introduced earlier this week as a silent time for Ethiopians in the Tigray region of Ethiopia to reflect about what they want to do. The decision was said to be informed in part to enable farmers to seize the opportunity for the sowing season during the rainy season without disturbance from a conflict situation. But it was also partly introduced to relieve the Ethiopian Defense Force from 8 months of law enforcement duty in the region without much support from residents in the region. Information revealed by the Prime Minister suggests that the Ethiopian Defense Force was attacked by TPLF-affiliated armed groups operating as civilians in various cities in the region. Some opposition parties in the country, including ones led by the ethnic Tigrayan politicians, are reacting to the unilateral ceasefire. Arwagewi Berhe, co-founder of the Tigray People's Liberation Front, the TPLF, currently leading Tigray Democratic Party as chairman, said people in Tigray region should not be collaborators to the terrorist group. He is making a reference to the party he helped establish in the late 1970s. He said so on Thursday in an interview with Ethiopian news agency. He also criticized the TPLF, saying it does not care for the people of Tigray, but for its power. Furthermore, Mr. Arik Gawi hailed Ethiopian government efforts to distribute humanitarian assistance after the law enforcement operation back in December. The Ethiopian government announced this week that it has spent 100 billion birr, that is well over 2 billion U.S. dollars, to address the humanitarian situation. Part of the support was channeled to TPLF forces in a corrupt way by supporters of the party. Also, Mr. Arik Gawi condemned the political narratives that TPLF is advancing currently in pursuit of succession. Professor Yeni Petros, another prominent opposition politician and leader of Ethiopian Social Democratic Party, said the Ethiopian government has done everything it can to support the Ethiopian people in Tigray under difficult circumstances. He also said that the declaration of unilateral ceasefire was a wise one, informed by a sense of humanity. For him, the law enforcement operation was undertaken diligently. And you're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. And in the southern African state of Eswatini, also known as Swaziland, the South African government has urged calm and restraint in Eswatini, formerly known as Swaziland, which has been engulfed by pro-democracy protests this week amid growing reports of state violence against demonstrators. Protesters are demanding democratic reforms and accuse King Mswati III, who has ruled the tiny mountain kingdom for more than 30 years, as an absolute monarch of repression. Rights groups accuse the royal family, including the king's 15 wives, of enjoying a lavish lifestyle while many of the country's 1.1 million people live in poverty. Mbabane, the capital, and Mazini, the largest city, have reportedly been the most affected by the protests, which have seen demonstrators barricading roads and setting fires often at businesses owned or linked to the royal family. Businesses, factories, and trucks have also been reportedly burned in the industrial town of Matsapa. The Eswatini government has imposed a nightly curfew from 6 p.m. to 4 a.m. to try to quell the demonstrations. Photographs and videos on social media show soldiers assaulting people believed to be protesters. Activists have alleged that soldiers and police have killed more than 20 protesters since the protesters began this week, but this has not been confirmed by police, government officials, or health workers. Acting Prime Minister Temba Mosuku claimed that the legitimate protests had been hijacked by criminal elements. In a statement on Thursday, South Africa's Department of International Relations and Cooperation said it noted, quote, with great concern, the ongoing political security situation in Eswatini. We are particularly concerned by reports of loss of life and destruction of properties. The right to peaceful protest is universally recognized, said spokesman Clayton Monyela. He called on Eswatini security forces to exercise total restraint and protect the lives and property of the people. The protesters are demanding reforms that include lifting bans on opposition political parties, which have been outlawed since 1973. Sonke Dube, president of the Swaziland Youth Congress, which is involved in the demonstrations, called on the United Nations, the 16-nation Southern African Development Community, and the African Union to intervene. Dube said in the statement that we urge you to call Mswati to order, isolate him from the community of peace-loving nations, pose sanctions on him and his immediate family and cronies until we have a people's government in Swaziland. South Africa's ruling African National Congress, which has historical ties to Swaziland, stressing from that country's support of its liberation struggle, has criticized the government for violence against demonstrators. ANC head of international relations, Lindiwe Zulu, said, quote, the use of security forces to quell political dissent and the failure to address legitimate civilian concerns complicates the conflict and adds fuel to the fire, unquote. The United States State Department 2 days ago upgraded its travel alert for Eswatini to warn Americans against any travel to the country and announced it would allow non-essential American diplomats and their families to leave due to the deteriorating security situation there. Eswatini is experiencing dangerous civil unrest and protests across the country, the State Department said, noting the imposition of a curfew, the closure of the international airport, and communications disruptions. A day earlier, the department has urged Eswatini authorities to exercise restraint and also maintain the utmost respect for human rights, unquote. As the situation continues to unfold, the United States is urging all stakeholders in the situation to not only remain calm, but also remain peaceful. That's according to Deputy Spokeswoman Jelena Porter, and she told this to journalists on Wednesday. And, of course, finally, in the city of Chicago, the anti-lynching crusader, journalist, and political activist, Ida B. Wells Barnett, has a monument erected to her. It was unveiled just this last past Wednesday. Officially called the Light of Truth, Ida B. Wells National Monument, the commemoration created by sculptor Richard Hunt was dedicated to the South Side neighborhood where Wells lived out her life. The monument has three bronze columns that support intertwined bronze sheets twisted into coral and spirals. One observer had trouble describing the abstraction at the top of the monument, asking if it was a hat or a crown of thorns. She was more certain about the columns. It is interesting, Peter Roberta Trotter told the Chicago Tribune. I just want to know what the artist thinks before I say more. But I do see a strong base that I understand. Ida was a strong woman. Granddaughter Michelle Duster said traditional busts and statues of Wells were considered, but she and others pushing for the monument preferred something interpretive, which she said projects Wells better than the literal. The monument to Wells was financed by contributions made during a fundraising campaign over several years led by Duster. It sits on the site of the Ida B. Wells Homes, the housing projects constructed in the 1930s and torn down in 2011 and replaced with market rates and subsidized housing. Hopefully, it becomes a point of pride to Bronzeville, the kind of thing people want to serve as a backdrop of their lives here, Duster said. That's what I want, a gathering spot. And with that, we want to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. Including this segment of our program, we want to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service that is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published thousands upon thousands of articles and dispatches in various newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's Pan-African News, www.blogspot.com. And if you'd like to have access to the Pan-African Journal, the worldwide radio broadcast, all you need to do is go to the Pan-African Radio Network. And that's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And, of course, you can have access to today's program as well as over 1,000 other archived editions of the Pan-African Journal. And we're going to take a break. We'll be back with more of our program for this week. Welcome back, and that was the sound of Mr. Chester Arthur Burnett, better known as Howlin' Wolf, with the song entitled Moaning at Midnight. And right now we want to move into our World Health Organization briefing, which we feature on a regular basis here at the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast. And, of course, the pandemic is still very much with us. The inequities in regard to vaccine distribution have reinforced the divisions and the level of exploitation between the majority of the world's population, those who live and who thrive, not necessarily live, but thrive within the Western capitalist states. And, of course, all of this is taking place within the context of growing discontent among oppressed, working, people of color communities, not only in the United States and North America, but indeed in Western Europe as well. So in bringing you these World Health Organization briefings, they are providing us a glimpse into the way in which the international community views the current world situation as it relates to public health.
Hello to everyone listening on Zoom or on WHO social media channels. Welcome to the regular COVID-19 press conference today, July 2nd. My name is Tarik Sharevich, and I will be helping with moderating the question and answer session. Today we will have a special focus on the results of Small Iceland Developing States Summit for Health that took place earlier this week. Dr. Tedros will introduce our very special guest today in a minute. I will just ask journalists to be brief in their question and ask only one question in any of six UN languages and Portuguese, and our interpreters will help with that. I will now give floor to Dr. Tedros. We have a number of WHO experts here in a room. I will just mention some of them are online, some of them are coming. As usual, we have Dr. Maria van Kerkhof, technical lead. Our chief scientist, Dr. Soumya Swaminathan, is also with us. Mariangela Simao, assistant director general, access to medicines and health products. We have Anne Lindstrom on phone, and she is unit head for essential routine on immunization. We also have Dr. Nedra Temiroglu, who is a director here in the role of independent panel. We have also some other people who may also be asked to help us with answering questions. With this, I give the floor to Dr. Tedros for his opening remarks.
Thank you. Thank you, Tarik. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. This week, WHO hosted a two-day summit with heads of state, heads of government, ministers, and civil society leaders from small island developing states, SIDS, which focused on building resilient health systems in the face of multiple threats. Climate crisis, the severe impact of the pandemic on lives and livelihoods, vaccine inequity, and the large burden of non-communicable diseases were discussed and concrete outcomes developed on how together we can tackle them. His Excellency, Gaston Brown, Prime Minister of Antigua and Barbuda, addressed the summit, and I'm pleased and honored he has joined us again today to give his perspectives on the urgent issues at hand. Your Excellency, Prime Minister, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Dr. Tedros, Director General, members of the media, distinguished ladies and gentlemen. I welcome this opportunity to brief the members of the press on the SIDS Summit outcome statement. First of all, let me thank everyone who participated in the first ever WHO SIDS Summit and for their contribution to the development of this excellent and pragmatic outcome, which calls for a healthy and resilient future. I think in Barbuda, as the chair of the Alliance of Small Island States, takes this opportunity to fully endorse the summit's outcome statement. The outcome statement captures the vulnerabilities of small island developing states, which are susceptible to the threats of economic shock, climate change, and the burden of non-communicable diseases, which have undermined the health and well-being of our citizens and residents. While mindful of our vulnerabilities and limited capacity, SIDS have been confronting the challenges with its limited resources, but our inadequate resources are now further strained by the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. SIDS vulnerabilities have worsened by the COVID-19 pandemic to the extent that achieving the Sustainable Development Goals and the aspirations of the Samoa Pathway will require a multidimensional approach including the support of the international community. The Sustainable Development Goals overarching principle is to leave no one behind, and SIDS are determined to achieve that goal. This all requires greater global collaboration and cooperation of the international community to develop more refined and bespoke development pathways for SIDS to effectively confront the challenges they are faced with. The health and well-being of SIDS must be seen as a global human right, justifiable on moral grounds, and our common humanity. This should be universally acceptable within the UN system and other development partners. Now, this outcome statement requires action by all and hinges on urgent intervention in addressing the unique vulnerability of SIDS and the inequalities that stand as obstacles to their development. It also firmly establishes health at the heart of climate action and the need to develop climate resilient health systems. However, health and economic resilience cannot be achieved by SIDS without the assistance of the international community. Hence, new inclusive funding mechanisms for sustainable financing should be developed to include debt for climate swaps and obligatory compensatory financial instruments for loss and damage as a result of damage from climate change disasters, and certainly funding for adaptation and mitigation. Eligibility for financing should be inclusive and based on vulnerability. To this end, the outcome statement reiterates the call for the development of a multidimensional vulnerability index to replace the flawed per capita income criterion. The outcome document also calls for ambitious measures to combat climate change and to protect the natural environment. However, I wish to add that profligate users of fossil fuels who have contributed to global warming and pollution, whose adverse climate actions have resulted in loss and damages in SIDS, should be legally obligated to make financial reparations for the damages, not for us as SIDS, vulnerable SIDS, to wait from or wait for handouts and promises, unfulfilled promises from these states. Now, this compensation should include debt write-offs for SIDS that have had to borrow repeatedly to rebuild from climate damage, resulting in unsustainable debt burdens. The outcome document addresses the burdens of malnutrition and undernutrition, necessitating interventions to ensure food security and adequate nutrition. It recommends pooled procurement among SIDS, especially for medicines and medical supplies, to reduce costs. In fact, pooled procurement has been successfully practiced in the OECS Caribbean sub-region for decades. It also acknowledges the need to acquire new technologies, including access to digital technologies, and the need for access to good quality education and lifelong learning. While we all can agree that we are small, our dreams and goals extend beyond our borders. SIDS have led many global initiatives that oftentimes serve as the anchor to many international agreements. We place entities on the global stage. We led the charge for 1.5 to stay alive as climate change disproportionately affects SIDS more than any other. Developmental challenges like pandemics and diseases, climate change and disasters, economic instability, and a lack of global economic opportunities, they compound the vulnerability of SIDS and create our overall development. Despite these challenges, our countries are innovators, and we have had successes in many areas. Antigua and Barbuda and other SIDS were among the first to have eliminated mother-to-child transmission of HIV. Right here in the Caribbean, we have Cuba as a small state that continues as a leader in healthcare and medicines. And many other SIDS are promoting the concept of universal healthcare with significant success despite their fiscal constraints. While we can list a few accomplishments, the world sometimes, you know, turns its back on us. And this is happening perhaps a little too often. And COVID-19, the pandemic, is a typical example as to how the international community has failed to assist SIDS in meaningful ways in order to deal with this global pandemic. Now, despite the good efforts of the COVAX facility, developed partners are not doing enough. With the economic onslaught of the pandemic, SIDS have limited access to vaccines. We still have a problem globally of vaccine nationalization. And that's compounded by the fact that travel and trade have been curtailed, thereby inflicting great wounds on our economy. So we now run the risk of disintegrating into what I consider to be economic sclerosis, eroding decades of hard-won gains. And that should not be allowed to happen. Our tourism industry is all but at a standstill. Our economies are shattered. And there's much anxiety among SIDS of the possibility of a protracted pandemic, which means that we all have to move in lockstep with each other in global solidarity in order to effectively defeat this pandemic. Now, it is therefore our hope that the WHO can begin the process of a pandemic and global health toolkit that is tailored to it. To achieve the objective of this outcome statement, we must all commit to take bold action, recognizing the interconnectedness of the human health of SIDS and sustainable development. This requires tackling the social determinants of healthy SIDS while promoting economic resilience for our countries. I close by thanking Dr. Tedros for his exemplary global leadership during this most challenging period. And I certainly thank him for his commitment and advocacy on behalf of SIDS. Finally, we welcome the recommendation for the establishment of a SIDS Leaders Group on Health for high-level advocacy. And I take this opportunity to charge everyone to use this summit outcome statement as a rallying call in addressing the health challenges of SIDS. I thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Prime Minister. Thank you for your leadership. And I couldn't agree more with you about the importance of looking at the multidimensional threats and working together to solve them. On an almost day-to-day basis, we are now seeing the impact of the climate crisis. Record-breaking scorching heat waves, catastrophic storms, and changing weather patterns are impacting food systems, disease dispersion, and societies at large. The time for lofty words is over. There needs to be concerted action backed by financial resources to mitigate the consequences of climate change while we work to keep temperatures down and scale green innovations. In terms of the small islands, they're very existence is at risk. As the Prime Minister noted, the same is true for vaccine equity in many respects. Many small island developing states have succeeded in preventing widespread transmission of COVID-19 in their communities. But the pandemic has hit you hard in other ways, such as declining revenues from tourism, which is affecting your economy significantly, compounded by more transmissible variants like Delta, which is quickly becoming the dominant strain in many countries. We're in a very dangerous period of this pandemic. In those countries with low vaccination coverage, terrible scenes of hospitals overflowing are again becoming the norm. But no country on earth is out of the woods yet. The Delta variant is dangerous and is continuing to evolve and mutate, which requires constant evaluation and careful adjustment of the public health response. Delta has been detected in at least 98 countries and is spreading quickly in countries with low and high vaccination coverage. There are essentially two ways for countries to push back against new surges: public health and social measures like strong surveillance, strategic testing, early case detection, isolation, and clinical care remain critical, as well as masking, physical distance, avoiding crowded places, and keeping indoor areas well ventilated are the basis for the response. And second, the world must equitably share protective gear, oxygen, tests, treatments, and vaccines. I have urged leaders across the world to work together to ensure that by this time next year, 70% of all people in every country are vaccinated. This is the best way to slow the pandemic, save lives, drive a truly global economic recovery, and along the way, prevent further dangerous variants from getting the upper hand. By the end of this September, we're calling on leaders to vaccinate at least 10% of people in all countries. This would protect health workers and those at most risk, effectively ending the acute stage of the pandemic and saving a lot of lives. It's a challenge, but we know it's possible because already 3 billion vaccines have been distributed. It is within the collective power of a few countries to step up and ensure that vaccines are shared, manufacturing is increased, and that the funds are in place to purchase the tools needed. There is now some sharing of vaccines happening, but it's still only a trickle, which is being outpaced by variants. In those countries whose hospitals are filling up, they need vaccines and other health tools right now. New manufacturing hubs, including for mRNA vaccines, are being developed, but this could be accelerated by companies openly sharing technology and know-how. In particular, I urge those companies like BioNTech, Pfizer, and Moderna to share their know-how so that we can speed up the development of new production. The sooner we start building more vaccine hubs and upping global vaccine capacity, the sooner we can diminish deadly surges. This week, the leaders of IMF, World Bank, WTO, and WHO met to look at practical ways to track, coordinate, and advance the delivery of COVID-19 vaccines to low and middle-income countries. Collectively, we also made several asks to the G20 to accelerate global efforts to reach our vaccine targets. Finally, some countries, regions have launched so-called vaccine certificates, and I want to make it very clear that it's important that these do not lead to discrimination against those people and countries that have either a lack of vaccines or certain type of vaccine. As you know, WHO issues emergency use listings for vaccines based on a stringent assessment of safety and efficacy, and we expect all countries to recognize and accept those vaccines that WHO has approved. Again, I would like to thank His Excellency Prime Minister Brown for joining us today. And now I will pass back to Tariq. Tariq?
Thank you very much, Dr. Tedros. Thank you very much, Your Excellency, Prime Minister Gaston Brown. I understand the Prime Minister will stay with us for some minutes, so hopefully we will hear from him when we come to questions from journalists. And we already have some journalists raising their hand, so we will start immediately with Laurent Sierro of Swiss News. Laurent?
Yeah, thank you, Tariq, for taking my question. A recent study by the University of Oxford a few days ago shows that period up to 45 weeks between two doses of AstraZeneca might improve the efficiency of that vaccine. As you're facing shortages in the framework of COVAX, are you going to take that into consideration to adapt the dispatch of doses in the next months in the different countries? Thank you.
Thanks for that question. I can start, and maybe Joachim Hombach is online and can add details. Yes, indeed, we saw that report showing that, you know, up to 10 months of a gap between the first and the second dose of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine still provided very good immunogenicity after the second dose, and, you know, had resulted in high levels of neutralizing antibodies. It is very reassuring, I think, for people and for countries where there may be a delay in obtaining the second dose. We know there are supply constraints, and many countries that received the first dose and have given the first dose to people do not have supplies for the second dose. COVAX is trying to address that. But in the meantime, it's reassuring that a longer gap beyond the 8 to 12 weeks that is currently recommended by WHO we're not going to pay a penalty for that. People will still mount a good immune response. But having said that, we also know that two doses of the vaccine, in this case the Chadox vaccine, is what gives full protection against disease. And so we do want people to get that second dose within the recommended interval of time so that they're fully protected within that period. So it's a trade-off between increasing the coverage for larger numbers of people with the first dose and providing full coverage, full protection to people which they get after the second dose. And particularly with the Delta variant, we do want that full protection. So as supplies increase, there should be no problems really in being able to give everyone their second dose in time. But studies like this help us to learn more about the immune response to vaccines and immunology, and also on the duration of protection that we get from vaccines. So it's very welcome, and we would like to see more studies like this on other vaccines that are being used around the world. Thank you. And see if Hombach wants to add something.
Thank you very much, Dr. Samnet. And online we have with us Dr. Joachim Hombach, who is a secretary to the SAGE. So Joachim, could you please unmute yourself and add if you wish?
Yes, thanks very much. I don't have much to add, but really also to underline again, this is great news, which adds flexibility to a schedule if it cannot be met as recommended if there's supply issues. But as already mentioned by Dr. Swaminathan, it is nevertheless important to underline this is a two-dose vaccine, and we know the two doses are needed to confer optimal protection, in particular against variants of concern. And so this is, I think, an important reminder. But otherwise, this is great news. Over.
Many thanks, Dr. Hombach, secretary to the SAGE. We will go to our next question. It's Michael Busirkiv, who is a contributor to CNN. Michael? Please unmute yourself.
Sorry about that.
Michael, unfortunately, you are really broken. We can't hear anything. So maybe we will try to take one more question and come back to you, Michael. So let's see if we can have Shoko from NHK.
Hello, Tariq, can you hear me?
Hi, Shoko, yes, please.
My question is not related to the special focus of today. Do you want to take other channels first, or may I continue with my question?
Yes, please.
Okay, thank you. So thank you for taking my question. There is an emerging study that mixing different COVID-19 vaccines for first and second doses produces a stronger immune response to the virus. This study of Oxford shows one dose of AstraZeneca vaccine followed by Pfizer one was nearly as effective as two doses of Pfizer one. My question is, if you are in an environment where it's difficult to obtain the same type of vaccines for both doses, does WHO recommend to take two different types of vaccines? And if yes, maybe mix any of the COVID-19 vaccines which are already registered in the emergency use listing, or do we need to wait until more studies to come, which combinations work and do not work? Thank you.
Thank you, Shoko. So I think Dr. Hombach would be a best place to answer this. Joachim, if you are there, please unmute yourself.
Yes, thanks very much. Thanks for that question. So, yeah, again, this is, I think, good news that we have obtained through this data, which again adds flexibility to countries if they face supply interruptions. So, and we have already in our position on the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine mentioned this, that the combination of AstraZeneca, and this is a vaccine where we had then in many countries have seen supply issues, followed by the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, results in very good immunogenicity data. So this is, I think, it's very good. It's reassuring. Both directions have now been tested, and this is the study you are referring to. And there is obviously many more so-called mix and match studies that are ongoing. What I don't think we can do is to provide a generic recommendation that you can mix and match in any way you want. This is product specific, and it is important that these data are being generated. And so we have to see, but there is a lot of studies ongoing. Again, we have now the data for Pfizer and AstraZeneca with a spacing of about a month. More data would be coming, but it's a great addition to flexibility. Whether this is, so to say, a more general principle that, you know, can be applied is something to be determined. Over.
Thank you very much. Let's go to next question. We have Megan Rowling from Thomson Reuters Foundation. Megan?
Hi, hello. My question is about climate change and health with relation to the SIDS conference earlier this week. The COVID pandemic has highlighted the linkages between climate change, health, and natural systems degradation, deforestation, and so on. And also now we're seeing heat waves hitting many parts of the world, which is also raising this issue up the agenda. So I'd like to know what WHO is planning to do that's new in terms of getting governments to respond on this and putting it on the agenda at COP26. And also, Prime Minister Brown, if you have any particular demands from the small island developing states side, I'd be interested to hear that too. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we should start with His Excellency Prime Minister. Prime Minister, would you like to address this question?
Sure. Thank you very much. I believe I made the point earlier in my statement that, you know, there should be some form of compulsory compensation by the large emitters to ensure that whenever countries, or let's say small island states, suffer the consequences of these storms and other climate events, to include droughts, ocean acidification, and the general degradation of our biodiversity, that there should be some form of reparation for the damages to ensure that something is enshrined in law for the large emitters who obviously are creating the conditions for global warming and pollution, thereby undermine our natural diversity and causing loss of lives and damage to property, we believe that there should be some legal mechanism to obligate these states to provide compensation and also to provide funding so that we could adapt and mitigate to the effects of climate change. I'm also of the view, too, that there should be specialized instruments. So, for example, there should be debt swaps in which we can literally have swaps for debt against climate investments. And also, I'm of the view, too, that there should be some program of debt write-offs for these countries that would have had to borrow repeatedly in order to repair the infrastructure as a result of these climate events. If we fail to make it obligatory, then we'll continue to have all of these, let's say, pledges, unfulfilled pledges of billions of dollars to be spent by these large emitters to assist with the adaptation and mitigation of against climate change. So I'm of the view that we now need to up the ante and to ensure that there's some form of legal obligation for compensation. And by so doing, I believe that countries will move faster towards achieving their Paris commitments, and obviously we take the necessary steps to transition into green energy and obviously to save the planet and to ensure the continuity or sustainability of human civilization.
Many thanks, Your Excellency. And to address the first part of the question on WHO, we are joined here in the room by Dr. Naoko Yamamoto, our Assistant Director General for Universal Health Coverage, Healthier Populations. Dr. Yamamoto.
Thank you very much. Thank you for this question. As WHO, as the Prime Minister said, that we are going to strengthen accelerate our support to the CIS country, and also we will strengthen our communication and partnership with other partners, including financing partners like a Green Climate Fund and others. And also we will work with the CIS country to amplify their voices in it and increase the visibility of the CIS countries at many international important political fora, including Food Systems Summit, COP26, and the Nutrition for Growth Summit, and so on. Also, we will follow up with CIS countries leaders group about our efforts and in the governing body of WHO, CIS country proposed to discuss at the governing body, and DG Tedros has already expressed his support to this. And also, we agreed to set the next summit meeting in 2023. But when we talk about specific issues of COP26, as WHO, we work with the UK government and also our partners to stress the health issues, including CIS country, at the COP26 this year in Glasgow. And we focus on the clean energy, clean cooking energy, as well as green health facility and so on. And we are going to amplify our CIS country's voices and our efforts at this COP26 as well. Thank you.
Many thanks, Dr. Yamamoto. Now we will try to go back to Michael Bosyurkiv to see if we have a better line. Michael?
Hello, can you hear me okay now?
Now it's better.
Okay, great. So greetings from Kiev. I'm here today. Dr. Tedros mentioned the climate crisis. Recently in my home province of British Columbia, we saw that unprecedented heat wave resulted in hundreds of sudden deaths. And There was delayed and poor public messaging, few cooling centers, and other shortcomings. My question is the following: whether there is a feeling that elected leaders coming out of this pandemic are taking on board a Build Back Better approach, not only when it comes to handling future pandemics, but things like climate emergencies, absorbing lessons learned, instituting better public health messaging. And I'll just read you very quickly, Sir Tadak, one quick line that I wrote. I said, perhaps it was naive to expect humanity to turn a global crisis into an opportunity. A virus, a pandemic, was a once-in-a-lifetime chance to unite against a common enemy, to embark on a process of building back better on contentious issues like fighting climate change. I'm wondering of your thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. So the question is about building back better. Maybe Maria, you can start, and I think we should also hear from Prime Minister on this question.
Yes, thank you very much. Thanks, Michael, for the question, and nice to hear your voice again. I mean, I think on the positive side, we are seeing some changes that are being made to be better prepared for the next one. I think we should make we should not mince words to suggest that there won't be a next one in terms of the next emerging pathogen or re-emerging pathogen, the next pandemic. But I would have to be honest and say it's not enough. You know, we are seeing a lot of countries using the current situation that we are in with COVID-19 and the trauma that all of us are facing because of this virus, the upheaval that all of us in all of our lives have experienced. And not enough, I would say, is being done to build the fundamental systems that we need in public health, the surveillance systems that we need, the testing systems that we need, including the use of novel testing that is coming online, the antigen-based tests that are there, the new technologies that are being advanced. We need more investment in our health and care workers around the world to ensure that we have more people who are trained appropriately, who are provided the protection that they need to carry out the life-saving work that they do every single day, to support more community health workers who are the foundation of public health in so many countries around the world. There needs to be much more of that. I think we need to do much more in building trust with our communities and keeping that trust, working hard to keep the trust of our communities, building the leaders, engagement, much more engagement, with community leaders, with religious leaders, with women, with youth, to be able to harness the energy and the innovation that we have for any of the challenges that we see going forward. And I think we need much more on the partnership side, the supply chains that were broken, that are being so hard, so many partners are working to rebuild, to be able to, once we do have supplies, to ship those supplies. And the partnerships that we have through R&D. I think the R&D side has been a real shining light in terms of this pandemic, but again, we need more. So I think the short answer is not enough, if I'm being honest, but I do want to be positive that it's not too late. My biggest worry that I have right now is that we don't use this current situation to make those changes. If we, quote unquote, wait until this pandemic is over, we won't do it. So we are seeing countries, and what we've learned from this COVID-19 pandemic is the countries that had experience with other infectious diseases across Asia and Africa and diseases like MERS, like SARS, like avian influenza, Ebola, I could go on and on, they built those systems over decades. And preparedness is a constant. It is not a start and stop. It doesn't stutter. It's a constant. It needs constant investment in terms of energy, political will, financing, and the money is there. We see it. We see the money being raised for COVID-19. That is something that really, really needs to be invested in going forward. I'm sure others will want to talk about healthcare, access to healthcare, and climate, but we could probably spend the next hour on that answer. But I really want to emphasize it's not enough. So let's turn that around and really put that emphasis in, and all countries need to be doing this.
Thank you very much, Tuvan Kekor. Maybe our Prime Minister would like to add something on the issue of building back better and turning this pandemic into opportunities. Your Excellency?
Thank you very much, Excellency. Evidently, you know, there was not sufficient effort in building resilient public health institutions prior to COVID. And I would say that one of the outcomes, positive outcomes of COVID is that most countries are now focusing on building greater health resilience to scale up their institutions to ensure that they have the supporting health institutions and the equipment, the technology, and even the staffing to deal with future pandemics. In fact, it was predicted decades ago that we would have been faced with a pandemic at some point, but evidently the issue did not get a lot of traction globally. So COVID-19 has now forced us to address the issue of health resilience within our respective states. And you recognize too that when this pandemic, or when this virus first surfaced, many global leaders were not taking it seriously. But again, the devastation to lives and livelihoods would have forced all of us as leaders globally to address the issue and also to build out our health infrastructure to ensure that we're better prepared for the next pandemic. And we know too that one of the consequences of climate change is the fact that more pathogens will be released and the likelihood of having future pandemics within a shorter period of time, maybe every several years, every decade, is likely. And that is one of the reasons to why we have to prioritize the issue of climate change in order to protect the planet and at the same time even to control or to reduce or eliminate, for that matter, the pandemics that may follow in the future. But perhaps the most significant lesson as a result of this pandemic is the need for global collaboration and recognizing to the extent of our vulnerability that we are as vulnerable as the weakest link. So, you know, those are positive areas of development for future strong global collaboration to deal with these pandemics in the future. And obviously to prioritize research and development and to make the necessary resources available. And we have seen, for example, that in the development of the COVID vaccines, that wealthy countries in particular would have allocated an enormous amount of resources in order to bring safe and efficacious vaccines to market within the shortest period of time. So again, I think that there have been some good lessons, and as we realign and certainly adjust, I'm quite sure that we'll be better prepared to fight future pandemics and perhaps reduce the extent of the economic and social damage that we'll have experienced from COVID-19.
Many thanks, Your Excellency. Dr. Tedros?
Yeah, just wanted to add, while agreeing with what Prime Minister said, the virus is a common enemy, and that's why we have to fight it in unison. And this virus, this pandemic, has also shown us the centrality of health. And that's why investment in health will be very important. And then if you take climate change, it's the same. It's a common problem that affects the whole world. But it also disproportionately affects the island countries, small island especially, more than any part of the world, although it's a problem for the whole world. When you see it in terms of islands, there are some projections, some islands may submerge. It's a matter of survival. But even if we say the projections are right and some countries could submerge, could be below sea, but it's only a matter of time until climate change affects others who are not an island, which is big countries or mainland. So it's a common problem. And when I come back to the question from Michael, the political commitment, I think, is necessary. But this is a matter of survival for the world. And if that cannot trigger political commitment, if the real and clear danger cannot provoke or bring political commitment, I cannot understand what else can bring commitment. And we have seen, by the way, during this pandemic, many countries were reporting that their ecology or their environment actually improving because of less interference and probably less pollution and so on. So it's a common problem. It's a matter of survival for the whole world. It's not the problem of the small island countries only. So that means it's everybody's problem. It's everybody's, and the solution is everybody's solution. And having a real commitment will be very, very important from all leaders.
Hey, thanks, Dr. Tedros, and thanks to Prime Minister and Dr. Van Kerkhove for addressing this question. We will now go to Avijit Mayumdar from AMN in India.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Oh, great. So my question is, you see, the virus is mutating, and you have the Delta variant at the moment. So the question is, how long will this virus go on mutating? How far do we see this coronavirus affecting our world? What is the period that we see at the moment? Do we see for a longer period? We are up against a very, very a long time for this pandemic?
So thank you. Thanks very much for the question. It's a big one. We definitely don't have a crystal ball to see how long this will last, but the virus is evolving. The virus has been evolving since it first emerged. This is what viruses do. So the variants of concern that we are tracking, there are four currently, the alpha, beta, gamma, and delta. And it's continuing to evolve. There will be more mutations. There will be more variants that will be detected. And some of those will be variants of concern. There are sublineages of the Delta variant that we're tracking as well. So the trajectory of this in each country is up to the plans that are in place and the ability to implement those plans. This comprehensive approach of surveillance, testing, early clinical care, isolation of cases, supported quarantine of contacts, the individual levels all of us can do with avoiding crowded spaces, knowing what our risk is every day and taking steps to lower our risk, wearing a mask, hand hygiene, physical distancing, et cetera, spending more time outdoors than indoors, improving ventilation and vaccination. All of these factors are part of the equation of when this pandemic will end. The goals that WHO have set, the strategic preparedness response plan that WHO has outlined, sets the course for ending the acute phase of the pandemic. There are many, many factors of this pandemic that we will need to deal with for many years, addressing the inequalities that existed before this pandemic and are exacerbated during this pandemic. But the trajectory and the outcome of this depends on our actions. So the DG has laid out the goals of the vaccination coverage that need to be met by the end of September, by the end of the year, by this time next year. There is production that exists. There are vaccines that are available. There are more vaccines that are being studied in phase two, phase three trials. There's tech transfer. There's a lot of positive things that are happening. We just need much more to be done to be able to get the vaccines to those who are most at risk in all countries. And then to be distributed even further once production continues to increase. But in the meantime, we still have the public health and social measures that work against these variants, including the Delta variant that is circulating in a number of countries around the world. So it's up to us in terms of what we do and how quickly we can end this pandemic.
Thank you, Dr. Van Kerkhove. We have time for one or two more questions. So let's go to Geneva-based Reuters correspondent Stephanie Nebehe. Stephanie, you have the floor.
Thank you, Tarek. Thanks very much. I wondered, I don't know who would be the right person to address this. Mike usually does, but I'm not sure he's there today. Given that WHO is advising the IOC and the Tokyo Organizing Committee, what lessons are you drawing from what's happened in Europe during the Euro 2020 soccer tournament, which WHO regional office has said has driven up new cases by 10% or so in the last week because of the mixing and so forth? So the question is, what sort of advice or what lessons are you drawing from that in advising the IOC and Tokyo Olympics organizers, please? Thank you.
Thanks for the question, Stephanie. It's also nice to hear your voice again. So as you know, Stephanie, we work with the IOC and other members and members who are handling sporting events around the world since the beginning of this pandemic, mass gathering events, to outline taking a risk-based approach and a risk assessment for each of the events that are happening, whether these are planned events or whether these are spontaneous events. And in doing so, having the plans in place. We've met several times with the IOC for the Olympic Games, but we do know that even small gatherings like backyard barbecues, if the virus is circulating and you don't take the proper precautions, the virus can spread. The IOC and others have outlined their plans in taking the approach for the Olympics, and we've been engaging with them and advising them on the best use of those plans. We are learning from Euro 2020. We are learning from many of the different events, whether these are religious-based events, whether there are events that are happening related to political rallies. If the virus is present and precautions are not in place, the virus will spread. So our European office has set up a dashboard looking at transmission around Europe and in tracking, in our normal surveillance activities, looking at the circulation of this virus. I do just want to, you know, we urge caution. We urge everyone to take caution in what they do. If you haven't been vaccinated or received the full doses of your vaccine, if you don't take the proper precautions, if the virus is circulating, you have an opportunity to become infected and pass that virus to someone else. So we urge everybody to take a risk-based approach in what they do, in the decisions that they make, the choices that they make, and the events that they attend have consequences, good and bad. So we will continue to track the spread and the circulation of the virus, continue to advise countries on the best use of the capacities that they have, taking into account all of the interventions that can be used to minimize the spread. The pandemic is not over, as we all know, and so it's really important that we continue every day to remain vigilant and do what we can to reduce the spread in our daily lives.
Thank you, Dr. Van Kerkhove. And we will take the last question for today's session. It's Ana Pinto from Folha de São Paulo from Brazil. Ana?
Hi, thanks, Derek. I have a question about the Lambda variant, the one who was identified in Peru, and I think it's now dominant in Peru, and I guess it's in about 20 different countries. And I know it's a variant of interest. My question is, when does a variant become from a variant of interest in a variant of concern? I've read that there are some unusual mutations in this Lambda variant, and I'd like to know what's the state of play of what do you know already about this variant, and if it's close to be considered a variant of concern. Thank you very much.
So thanks for this question. The Lambda variant, the C37, is a variant of interest that WHO is tracking at the global level. So the way that we discuss and characterize these variants, we work with a group of scientists around the world, our different networks. We bring in expertise with virology, with epidemiology, clinical management, people with bioinformatics, so that we can analyze and study the sequences that are shared. Through platforms like GISAID, and then we discuss the constellation of mutations, the combination of mutations that are identified. The Lambda variant currently is characterized as a variant of interest at the global level. It would become a variant of concern if it has demonstrated properties of increased transmissibility, if it has increased severity, for example, or if our countermeasures has some kind of impact on our countermeasures. And we look at the geographic distribution of the spread of these different variants. And so we characterize these through a combination of technical consultations that we have with our expert networks, using the information that we have on the variant, the specific mutations they have, any studies that are done in people, any studies that are done in the lab, and then we do this routinely, regularly. Our virus evolution working group meets every 2 weeks, but internally we have meetings through our epi teams, our lab teams, our regional teams. We meet with many of the different CDCs around the world, virtually, of course, every week, to discuss. We work with our regional offices, so there's a lot of information and gathering of information. So it's a dynamic process. So if that is demonstrated to meet the characteristics of a variant of concern, we will, of course, classify it as a variant of concern. But I do think what you raise is important. It's about the process to understand, you know, what is out there. We are limited in our ability to understand virus evolution because of sequencing that is happening around the world. The amount of genetic sequencing that is happening has increased substantially over time, and there are more than 2 million full genome sequences that have been shared on GISAID, for example. But we need better geographic representation of the viruses and the sequencing of those viruses around the world. We're working through our regional offices. We're working with many partners around the world to build that capacity and enhance that capacity, which will not only be beneficial for SARS-CoV-2, but will be beneficial for any future pathogen, future viruses, future pathogens that emerge. So this is a work in progress. And it, of course, also relates to the other question, deserves investment. And we're grateful for partners who are working with us to really invest in this really critical aspect of surveillance of these variants.
Just wanted to add to what Maria has said is another important issue that we are tracking is the effectiveness of vaccines against different variants that are circulating, particularly the variants of concern. As you heard, it's one of the criteria that are used to define a variant of concern is if that variant has a lower capacity for neutralization by antibodies, either after natural infection or after vaccines. The information on this is rather patchy, particularly for some of the vaccines that are being widely used. So we have a lot of information, for example, on the Pfizer-BioNTech and the AstraZeneca vaccines from many countries on effectiveness, on the prevention of not only severe disease, but also infection and transmission to contacts, but much less information on some of the other vaccines, which are also widely used. So WHO is really promoting the idea of well-designed and well-conducted vaccine effectiveness studies, and our regional offices are working with countries to try to promote that kind of data collection, both on the safety but also on the effectiveness of vaccines, because this is going to be very helpful for us as we continuously examine data that's coming in and reassuring ourselves and the public that the vaccines that we're using are currently are still effective against these variants. And as of now, against the Alpha, Beta, Gamma, and Delta, we have some confidence that they are working and they're still preventing very high protective efficacy against severe disease. But we need to continue to watch that space as well. Thank you.
Many thanks to Dr. Van Kerkhove and Dr. Swaminathan for this important message on variants and vaccines. As we are coming to the end of our press briefing, I would like to invite His Excellency Prime Minister Gaston Brown to make some final comments. Your Excellency.
Thank you very much. And let me thank Dr. Tedros and the others at the WHO for giving AMCID this great platform to bring global awareness to the issues affecting SIDS, and obviously their own commitment to help us to achieve, let's say, a healthy and resilient future. And I also want to thank the members of the media in advance for helping us to, let's say, transmit this information globally so that global leaders will understand the challenges facing our countries, the vulnerabilities, and the need for international collaboration and cooperation in order to ensure that SIDS will enjoy a healthy and resilient future. Thank you once again. And again, I appreciate the opportunity to participate in this press conference. Thank you.
Many thanks, Your Excellency, for being with us today and sharing your thoughts on important issues that were raised this week at the summit. Before I hand over to Dr. Tedros for his final words, just to remind everyone that we will send audio file from this briefing tonight, and the transcript will be available tomorrow. For any additional questions, And to those journalists whose questions we were not able to take, please contact us at media@who.int and we will try to assist. Dr. Tedros.
Thank you. Thank you, Tariq. I would like to start by thanking His Excellency Prime Minister Brown for joining us today and also for his leadership. I would also like to thank the media group who have joined today, and have a nice weekend to all. Bon weekend.
Welcome back. And that was a WHO global briefing on a number of public health issues, of course, including the current COVID-19 pandemic, among other issues. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, the worldwide radio broadcast for Saturday, July 3rd, 2021. And we're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'll thank all of our listeners for tuning in. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of our program for this week.
And for love's sake, each mistake, oh, you forgave. And soon both of us learn to trust, not run away.
There was no time to play.
We build it up
and build it up.
Now it's solid. Take a chance.
Welcome back, and none other than Nick Ashford and Valerie Simpson with their big smash hit, Salad of the Rock. And right now we want to move into our concluding segment, and that is the Africa Live from CGTN. This is from yesterday, July 2nd, covering many of the issues from Africa, Asia. Deals with the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Chinese Communist Party, among other issues. Let's listen in.
This is CGTN, China Global Television Network.
China says goal realized of a moderately prosperous society. Rife COVID-19 variants fuel Africa's surging wave. And Libya talks continue in Geneva to pave the way for December elections. Hello and welcome to Africa Live, only on CGTN. I'm Maher Mutwa in Nairobi. Ramanyang also joins me now with your business headlines.
That's right, Mahir. Here's what's coming up in the next half hour. An oil deal hangs in the balance as key members of OPEC and its allies disagree. And Nigeria is set to start construction of a $1.2 billion rail line linking the northern cities of Kano and Kaduna. We'll have the details on those stories and plenty more coming your way in the course of the hour. For now, let's start with the latest in current affairs with Mahir.
Rama, thank you. We begin the top of the hour in China. The country says it has met another milestone in its economic development. As the Communist Party marks 100 years, it announced the achievement of its first centenary goal of building a moderately prosperous society. Let's have a look at what this means for China and its people.
What is Shao Kong society and how is it measured? Shao Kong society means building a moderately prosperous society in all respects. The concept is measured in multiple aspects, including economic, political, cultural, scientific, and ecological developments. China officially set the goal of achieving a Shao Kong society during the 12th National Congress of the CPC in 1982. One target was to double the country's 2010 GDP and per capita disposable income by 2020. Last year, it achieved that goal. GDP increased from around 40 trillion yuan in 2010 to more than 100 trillion yuan, about 15.4 trillion US dollars, in 2020. Its per capita disposable income hit over 32,000 yuan, nearly 5,000 US dollars, double the level in 2010. In addition to these economic developments, China has developed the world's largest social security system and boasts the world's biggest middle-income group, with around 400 million people. It has also significantly increased the education level of the entire population. In 2010, the number of people with a university education was nearly 9,000 per 100,000 people on the Chinese mainland. That rose to over 15,000 in 2020. China also ranked 85th on the UN Human Development Index in 2018. The index measures average achievement in three areas of human development: a long and healthy life, knowledge, and a decent standard of living. Eradicating poverty has been one of the greatest challenges in China's goal of building a moderately prosperous society. Over the past 40 years, about 770 million people have been lifted out of extreme poverty, meeting the poverty eradication target set in the UN's 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development, 10 years ahead of schedule.
Meanwhile, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi gave a speech in Cairo on the occasion of the 100th anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party. Let's take a look.
Your Majesty Xi Jinping, Secretary General of the Chinese Communist Party, the President of China, it gives me honor and appreciation to extend my deep to congratulate the Chinese people on the occasion of the 100th anniversary of the establishment of the Communist Party, this great party that led China successfully secured independence and developed the modern China since 1949. It has been leading the country by wise policies and achieved the Chinese miracle that made China to be one of the superpowers in the whole world. It reflects the significance of the Chinese civilization, and it is a driver for development. The Chinese experience is considered successful example to be followed by others and to be considered and studied by other countries. The party succeeded under your leadership to achieve great successes, and we congratulate you for this achievement. The first achievement is the developed country, and this is a reflection of the sincere leadership, the determination of the Chinese people. Your Majesty, I pledged with you in different meetings to push forward our friendship relations, and today we are seeking to promote our strategic relations to achieve better results. COVID-19 pandemic proved that cooperation among countries, the ability to develop integration at different levels is a main factor to secure stability in the international community, and we are joining efforts together to achieve more successful experiences, and we are supporting the national efforts to overcome the international challenges. And I pay a tribute to efforts exerted by Chinese government in cooperation with the Egyptian government to face off the COVID-19 pandemic. Your Majesty, if we consider the history, we can remember that the first national conference of the Chinese Communist Party, which comes at the same date of the Egyptian Revolution in 1952, and the party was established in 1920. This revolution paved the way to develop the country and develop the liberalization of different African countries. Egypt was the first African and Arab country in the Mediterranean region to recognize the Chinese Republic, the achievement of the Chinese Party, and establish the relations with China. And this year we will celebrate the anniversary of 65 years of this relation. And again, I congratulate Your Majesty, Chinese people, on the occasion of the Chinese Revolution, and I convey the greetings of the Egyptian people to you on that occasion, and we pray to God to keep our countries safe and to keep our people safe, and peace be upon you all.
Let's take a look at reactions from around the world. In North Africa, Yasser Hakim spoke with Sarah Kira, who is an international relations specialist as well as founder and director of the European North African Center for Research. Kira spoke about the feedback to Chinese President Xi Jinping's speech on the centenary.
China has succeeded on both domestic level and international relations level. In the domestic level, we have seen the development taking place around all sectors in China, and being very silent about its experiment and being very, very progressive on it. International relations level, China has a very impressive role in peace building and development. And it's very important for countries of Africa and for Egypt, of course. Egypt is the most important strategic partner of China in the Mediterranean. China now being already declared as a superpower, and apparently the balance of powers in the world is shifting towards Pekin. So today we see a regional power in a strategic partnership, a very good strategic partnership built on development and peace building in the region with China. This is quite a new experiment to the whole international community. The future will hold a lot of tensions with other superpowers, great and deeper strategic partnerships with countries like Egypt, and more of maybe trade wars, currency wars, as we witnessed starting from 2009 with the U.S. in business and financing and economy and development. That will be very hard to push against.
Now, Zimbabwe's ruling party, ZANU-PF, has spoken highly of General Secretary Xi Jinping's speech at the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Communist Party of China.
ZANU-PF has praised the Communist Party of China as it marked the centenary of its founding on Thursday. Ties between Zimbabwe and China have deepened since the southern African country gained independence from Britain 41 years ago. Albert Mpofu, who is the Secretary for Administration in the ruling party in Zimbabwe, says China's growth over the past 100 years is impressive.
See, the first impression I get each time I go to China is that it is a fast-growing economy. This is due to the progressive and the clear ideological thrust that the Chinese leadership has embarked upon. See, we have been going through your successive leadership, and now you have the most progressive and the ideologically clear leader, Xi Jinping, president, who we draw a lot of inspirations from. We've learned a lot, we read a lot about his vision, his ideals, which are current. They address the current trends happening in the world. And the manner this Communist Party administers its socio-economic, political activities is beyond any other policies that I've seen in around the world.
Mpofu believes that under the leadership of the CPC, China has set an example for many African countries, including Zimbabwe.
There is a clear commitment by the Chinese people to what they are doing. They believe in what they are doing. And this is the orientation they get from the leadership, which is a leadership that has got foresight, vision to develop its economy. So the CPC is playing a major role because it is the one that guides the implementation of all the policies and decisions that the party will have come up with. You also get new ideas from the leadership. And this is not only from the central government, but even from the provincial governments. There is equal development everywhere. And this development addresses the aspirations of the people. So to us, China is not only a good friend, but also an inspirational friend in its way of doing things.
China has taken a leading role in modernizing Zimbabwe's agriculture, telecommunications, and mining sectors. The two countries have cooperation agreements in education, science, and health. Nokutula Shabalala, CGTN.
And South Africa joined in centenary celebrations for China's ruling Communist Party. The Chinese embassy in Pretoria held a digital reception with several political leaders. On the momentous 100-year commemoration, China committed to working for world peace, development and order. It also laid out plans for the second centenary, among them firm support for economic and human development in Africa. CGTN's Julie Shire now reports.
The Communist Party of China turned 100, marking the occasion with elaborate celebrations. South African political leaders joined the world in a digital commemoration.
We also pay homage to the founding father of the Chinese Communist Revolution and founder of the CPC, Mao Zedong, who was not only responsible for countless political initiatives that transformed China and its future engagement with the world, but who also led the fight against class distinction.
The CPC has led the country since 1949, when China was poorer than many African countries. It's become the only country in the world to eradicate poverty, something the developing world is still battling with.
It takes a dedicated and disciplined political leadership that is guided by a well-thought-out plan to have a fully functional government that is results-driven. We have for some years been struggling to reboot our sluggish economy. We have not been able to fully arrest some of the poverty, especially in the rural areas.
Since President Xi Jinping took office in 2013, he's placed great emphasis on China's relations with Africa.
He has visited Africa four times, including three state visits. In 2015 and 2018, our two presidents chair to historical Bohak summit held in Johannesburg, Beijing, respectively. The 10 cooperation plans and 8 major initiatives of China-Africa relations have helped Africa achieve long-term stability and sustainable development.
It's time for the next chapter. China has committed to standing by South Africa and other countries, especially as the continent battles COVID-19.
We welcome all countries, including Africa, to get on board the bullet train China demands. We are ready to deepen the exchange of experience in governance so that all countries could explore development paths in line with one's own national vision.
China is working to deliver a new vision and to build a development paradigm over the next 100 years for countries around the world to share opportunities. Julie Shara, CGTN, Cape Town, South Africa.
The World Health Organization Africa region has warned the new and faster spreading COVID-19 variants are fueling Africa's surging third wave. The World Health Body says cases in Africa have increased for 6 weeks running now, rising by 25%. CGTN's Daniel Arapmoy reports.
With case numbers doubling in Africa, focus is fast turning to the new spreading variants. The Delta variant is reportedly spreading to a growing number of countries. The variant has so far been reported in 16 African countries, including 9 with surging cases.
With the rampant spread of more contagious variants, the threat to Africa rises to a whole new level. Among the 14 African countries now in resurgence, 12 have detected variants of concern, including 9 with the Delta variant. SWHO was supporting countries to track variants in coordination with a network of reference laboratories.
In Uganda, the Delta variant has been detected in 97% of samples sequenced and 79% in the DRC. 66% of all severe illness in people younger than 45 years in Uganda is being attributed to the Delta variant.
Some evidence also suggests that the Delta variant is linked to people experiencing longer or more severe illness. This is consistent with devastating news being reported in countries of scores of patients dying due to a lack of oxygen supplies.
With rising case numbers and hospitalizations, the World Health Organization estimates that oxygen demand in Africa could rise above 50%.
The World Health Organization has made a call for everyone to act now and boost preventive measures to stop an emergency becoming a tragedy. Daniel Arap Moi, CGTN, Nairobi, Kenya.
Now, leprosy is an endemic disease in Nigeria and is becoming an increasing public health concern as the country is faced with tackling the COVID-19 pandemic at the same time. At a United Nations Human Rights Council session, which began in June and will run till mid-July, human rights abuses of people affected by leprosy are being addressed. Some non-governmental organizations are calling on Nigerian authorities to step up and do more to reduce the scourge of leprosy. Our correspondent Phil Ihaza tells us more from the capital, Abuja.
38-year-old Peter Iyuki has been affected by leprosy since he was 6. Peter says life has not been easy after losing his job last year.
I was working with a missionary hospital, but as of last year, January, I was sacked from the hospital because of the COVID. They say that as COVID have come, there are not any money as before, so they will not be able to keep some of the staff, so they dropped some of us.
According to the Nigeria Center for Disease Control, over 3,500 people get infected with leprosy every year in Nigeria. It's a bacterial infection that, if not treated early, can damage the nervous system and cause loss of muscle function, numbness, deformity, and even paralysis. Due to stigmatization towards people affected with leprosy in rural areas, many patients are often cast out from their communities.
Lepers here say their plight has worsened since the advent of COVID-19, especially with job losses, disruption of medication, food and other relief materials. Many say they've been forced to turn to begging so they can survive.
And that's why some non-governmental organizations like the Leprosy Mission Nigeria are doing their bit to assist them.
What we do for people who already have leprosy like this, we do empowerment and livelihood. And what that simply means is that we do vocational training for people like this, and we do skill acquisitions. And at some point, after the training, we give them set up material, sometimes funds, and sometimes we buy maybe sewing machine, and some of them who go into plumbing and all that. We get them to start up something.
But they say more needs to be done for patients.
Our support is not enough, the ones we have been doing so far. So we need more support from the federal government so to help us to bridge that gap, you know, in terms of vocational training. Stigmatization is a very huge issue. If the government can, it's all about sensitization. Public awareness campaign. It should not be a one-off thing. It should be a continuous thing.
President Muhammadu Buhari passed the Disability Bill in 2019 that criminalizes discrimination against people with disabilities and enforces their rights and privileges to education, healthcare, and accommodation. But until the effect of the bill is felt by people like Peter, life remains difficult. Phil Ihaza, CGTN, Abuja.
You're watching Africa Live on CGTN. Stay with us as we take a short break. Here's what's coming up on the other side. Libya talks continue in Geneva to pave the way for December elections. And Kenya reports a drastic rise in teenage pregnancies.
Africa is a continent of diversity, with varied climates and enchanting geography, and a people so distinct, but with a shared enduring spirit. We are at the heart of the continent, to bring you the untold stories.
Let's have a look.
We celebrate Africa as it shapes its own destiny.
I've been Shirishi, Tunis, Cairo,
Syria,
Juba,
Johannesburg,
Ethiopia,
Tanzania.
Africa Live. Find your voice.
Welcome back. Now, Libya delegates have been meeting this week in Geneva for UN-facilitated talks. Around 75 representatives from the Libyan government and its rival administrations are attending the talks. Their aim is to create the legal conditions for presidential and parliamentary elections, which are scheduled for December. The UN envoy to Libya says delegates should not leave Geneva without reaching a constitutional agreement. In the event that consensus cannot be reached, the UN envoy has urged delegates to vote on the proposal. Since October, Libya's warring factions have stuck to a historic ceasefire that ended months of violence there. Libyans hope the ballot will usher in peace and stability for the North African country. While the U.S. has been in talks with key actors in Libya over the withdrawal of foreign forces ahead of elections planned for December this year, Libya has suffered a decade of chaos and violence since a 2011 NATO-backed uprising ousted the then head of state, Muammar Gaddafi. CGTN's Daniel Arapmoy now reports.
Libya has experienced a massive influx of foreign fighters since 2011. The United Nations estimates that at least 20,000 foreign fighters and mercenaries are present in Libya. The country's unity government is now seeking international support for their withdrawal.
Libya is a positive example in the international arena that we are able to solve conflicts with political means. Hence, the development of Libya in the last couple of months was a positive one. The ceasefire is holding, and today we want to make sure that this continues to be the case.
The call for departure of the mercenaries is said to be essential for the Libyan state to assert its sovereignty. Foreign fighters present in Tripoli include Syrians, Russians, Sudanese and Chadians. Many other groups have since tried to take control of Libya, using private military contractors to bolster their fighting forces.
According to the United Nations, Libya's neighbor Tunisia has contributed the largest number of foreign fighters.
Libya has been split between rival East and West-based administrations, each backed by armed groups and foreign governments. But now there is a new unity government led by interim Prime Minister Abdul Hamid Deibar. Daniel Arap Moi, CGTN, Nairobi, Kenya.
Now, a worrying increase in teenage pregnancies is emerging amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Kenya is among the countries that have seen a dramatic rise in these cases, in Kilifi, a town on the Kenyan coast being among the worst affected. Still, driven by a desire for education, many girls will carry the pregnancy through school or even return as young mothers. CGTN's Nick Mudimba has more.
An ordinary weekly assembly. Only that some of the attendees at Kasamba Primary School in Kenya's Kilifi County are not your ordinary pupils. They're soon to be mothers. Others already mothers. 17-year-old Pamela Menza is one of them.
I got pregnant in June last year. I conceived when the pandemic hit. I gave birth and came back to school. I almost gave up coming back to school. My mother supported my return. In this situation, I only get to do my homework on Saturday and Sunday. At some point, I was demoralized after the return because I failed the exams. But my mother was my greatest supporter.
That much needed support, though, comes at a price. Every day, Pamela has to cut short her classes, rush home to breastfeed her baby. She also has to take care of her younger siblings, then return for the afternoon classes. Pamela's mother, Priscilla Mungo, knows it's not easy, but she's keen to see her daughter get an education.
My daughter got pregnant at grade 7. She was 16 years old. I was so sad. I questioned myself how she would turn out to be. But after consulting and also talking to her, I got the help and my daughter is now back to school.
Already, Kenya has acknowledged teenage pregnancy as a major challenge. In 2020, during the 3 months of lockdown, 152,000 teenage girls became pregnant, a 40% increase in the country's monthly average. Kilifi was one of the worst affected, with a 22% increase of teenage pregnancies. A lack of knowledge about sexual health and family planning are some of the factors blamed for the worrying figures. During our visit at Katama Primary School, we spoke this girl. She wasn't comfortable to tell her story on camera, but she too is pregnant. Teachers here say due to stigma, many girls will hide the pregnancy. Others end up dropping out of school and get married. At just 16, Elena Mwalimu is a single mother. When she got pregnant, she dropped out of school and got married. But her young husband took off, leaving her with no option but to fend for her baby.
My parents were against my return to school. I apologized and went back. The challenges were many. I had to walk long distances to and from school. I came here to work due to the long, tough situation. I had to cater for the baby and my siblings because at the moment I have no work.
Elena, though, remains hopeful that the future could be anything including brighter. She wants to go back to school. For now, though, feeding her baby is a priority. Societal pressure has pushed them back to school, back to the drawing board, hoping that one day they'll use this as a catapult to improve their lives. Right now, all they need is just the papers for them to progress carefully and, of course, this time around, with a lot of caution in their lives. Nick Mudimba, CGTN, Kilifi County, Kenya.
Now we continue our series about COVID-19 heroes in Africa. In Egypt, Yasser Hakim met with Ahmed Yahia, a 23-year-old truck driver based in Cairo. He recently bought his own truck to continue delivering goods during the pandemic.
I'm married and have one child, a 1.5-year-old son. I bought this vehicle 3 months ago to transport any products like furniture, as you can see here. When the coronavirus started, work slowed down. I only work 3 days a week, not much. I would agree to any orders. Everyone was afraid of the coronavirus, so demand dropped. The good work during that period was in vegetables. Delivering to the markets was going well, especially vegetables. It was going well. I mix with a lot of people, so I wear the mask all the time and have the alcohol on me. I sanitize the products I deliver. I then sanitize myself before I go home and immediately take a shower at home to protect myself and my family. The most vulnerable are the ones in my line of work because we mix with many people in markets, apartments and villas, and we can catch the virus easily. Now things are better and work has increased. Thank God it's better. Before we worked 3 deliveries a week, now up to 5 deliveries a week. And it could be more than 1 delivery a day. Thank God. I don't think Corona will disappear. Everyone here says it will continue with us and maybe increase again. No one said it will disappear. Don't think it will end. I heard they are still opening registration for vaccination. I will register soon for myself and my family. I will apply for vaccination.
Well, it's just about time for the latest in business. Rama is back with the latest.
Thank you very much, Mahia. Here's what's coming up in business news. An oil deal hangs in the balance as key members of OPEC and its allies disagree. And Nigeria is set to start construction of a $1.2 billion rail line linking the northern cities of Kano and Kaduna.
How will your world change today? What happened?
Welcome back. And that was Africa Live from CGTN discussing many of the burning and pressing issues of the day. And that's going to conclude our Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio broadcast program for today, Saturday, July 3rd, 2021. We've been broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. And if you'd like to have access to this program, just go to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And the Pan-African Newswire is a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week international press agency. And the Pan-African Radio Network is a counterpart of the Pan-African Newswire. Programs you listen to here over the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast can be shared via copying and pasting emails, copying and pasting them on blogs and websites, as well as sharing the links through social media networks such as Facebook and Twitter. This is Abayomi Azikiwe. Have a beautiful, beautiful week. Thank you.